What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Rockcast. Jordan here, and we are back with a brand new episode. We have Evan Sambita on with Sambita Custom Knives. And Evan, thanks for taking some time to hop on and talk about knives.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Heck yeah. So can you give people just a little introduction and background? I think mostly we'll go into like your background on knives and building and things.
Yeah. Well, my background's different than a lot of guys in the hunting world. I grew up in a place that didn't have much access to hunting, and it was all small little, you know, parcels of private, and everybody was paranoid about getting sued from everybody else. And so pretty much didn't have that much access. And so, but I did have access to camping and playing around with, you know, starting fires and stuff like that. So I got into the whole world of bushcraft and survival stuff, and just because it was cool. And that led me to discovering some cool custom knives in the market that could do some really cool stuff, and couldn't afford it. And so I decided, well, why can't I just make one? And so I got some really rudimentary stuff and started making knives. And at some point they stopped being hideous and started making sense and started being functional. And then I ended up moving down to Southern Ohio, and I've got a lot of access to public land and I can hunt a lot. And so started making more sense to make something that has more application in the field for hunters. And that's kind of where, I don't know, 90% of my efforts are at now, doing some pretty cool stuff for, you know, breaking down animals and things like that.
Yeah, dude, that's awesome. When you were starting, what did you get to start out with? Like a forge and the whole nine?
Well, so there's two different ways of going about knife making, and two major ways. One is forging. Everybody thinks of forging, you know, that big dude with arms bigger than his head. Yeah. And, you know, swinging a big hammer at a coal forge. And the other method is stock removal. And that's where you buy stock that's oversized and you cut and grind and drill it into shape. And then you heat treat it and then you finish it and put your handles on and things like that. And I went the stock removal route. The forging thing, it's crazy cool. A lot of fun to watch. It mystifies me, but I don't like there's more precision, like in my mind, to stock removal. You can measure stuff and things like that. Instead of shaping hot metal, you're removing stuff that you don't want to be there till you get nice clean edges, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the way I went. But I ended up just going to Harbor Freight and buying a super cheap 1x30 belt sander. It runs kind of like a little bandsaw, only it's got a belt, and burned through a whole lot of really cheap hardware store belts, cutting up steel to make some really ugly knives. And you know, at some point I got fed up with it and bought a nicer grinder, and it's kind of where I'm at now.
Gotcha. Dude, that's awesome. So I thought we'd just go through and talk about, I did put out a Q&A, and most of the questions we got were how to sharpen in the field and then different steels. So we'll go into that a little bit kind of towards the end of this, but I just wanted to get your thought process behind the knives that you build. Like if there's a certain, like what you go for when you're choosing a steel, a blade shape, like a size, a handle shape, kind of what's your thought process when you're starting a knife?
Yeah, no problem. The my Meadowlark model is like my flagship model, and that's, I'll kind of use that as an example, because that to me is like my ideal, or my idea of the perfect field knife for the backcountry hunter. And it's kind of my amalgamation of all my ideas of what's ideal. Sweet. Put together. And it's basically, it's got a 2 3/4 inch blade, and I'll explain why in a second, but the handle's just about 4 inches, and it's got a skinny handle, but it's not like these skeletonized knives that are super popular right now. Like those ones, they cramp up in your hand. Mm-hmm. Real bad after a little while. And anyway, it's designed to fit the hand really well without cramping up. At the same time, it's still nimble. It's not like these, you know, sporting goods store giant skinning knives that everybody thinks they need to have.
Yep.
And I can tell you've had experiences with those. But anyway, the 2 3/4 inch blade, the idea behind that length was, I wore, like, my hands are a little bit snug in a size large glove, for reference. But if you hold the knife with three fingers and your index finger runs along the spine of the knife, the tip of the knife ends up just like an eighth of an inch past your fingertip. And so when you're working up inside the chest cavity of, you know, an elk or a bear or whatever, going to cut the trachea and things like that, you're always spatially aware of where your fingertip's at. And then you're spatially aware of where the blade's at. A longer blade is just a liability. And you don't really need much more than 2 3/4 to get the job done. I cut up a bear last year in Idaho with a 1-inch blade. So, I mean, did I want to have a longer blade? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a 2.5-inch blade would be great, but you don't need a lot. And some of these guys are using disposable knife blades and getting a whole lot of cool stuff done, and they don't feel hampered at all. So, you know, to me, it seemed like the ideal size. But from there, I use about 82,000 thick stock for that knife. It's a nice trade-off between rigidity, toughness, and weight. And I'll skeletonize the tang, so I cut out a bunch of holes, basically, in the tang underneath the scale material just to reduce some weight. And then I use a synthetic handle material, unless, you know, requested otherwise, just to make it, you know, tough. At the same time, it looks good. And that pretty much leaves you with a really tough, good-looking knife that'll hold an edge for a long time and do everything you need to do without taking up a ton of room in your pack.
Yeah, that's awesome. With the handle, are you doing all that yourself too?
Yeah. Yep. That's all by hand. And I don't have any like CNC machines or anything like that. So it's all done by eye and by hand, and, you know, I just grind away the stuff that's not supposed to be there until I have the knife, you know?
Yeah. Nice. This is just kind of random. I thought of it. What do you think of the blades that are like towards the tip? The back of them are also sharp.
I'm not a fan. To me, that's more of a tactical, you know, or tactical, depending on what crowd's endorsing them. Knife. I don't think it has a whole lot of, like, this is for me. Like, there are people that are probably going to disagree, but for me, they don't have that much of a place in, you know, cutting up animals and stuff, just because that back edge is a liability. Gets in the way, and I like having my finger along the spine of the knife, and I can't do that if it's sharp. So now a swedged edge, which is a false edge, that can be useful. You look at a lot of the buck hunting knives from back in the day. Mm-hmm. They had those false edges, and they look like they're sharp, but they're not. And those are there because they thin your tip out. Makes the tip of the knife more pointy or slicey at the same time. You know, it's not sharpening the back of them. It makes the tip like more prone to breaking if you're not careful with them, but it lets you get into tighter areas and have less resistance when you're cutting. So they have their place, but as far as actually sharpened edges on the back, I'm not a fan.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. So what, for somebody that's just going to look for a knife, you know, maybe they have like one of those old school hunting knives and they want to get something that's a little more packable, but of course they just want to get one. What is the best process for them to go through for like choosing a knife for a certain application? And I would say, I just kind of contradicted myself, but maybe let's say like a knife for only skinning. Say they're doing something like, you know, we're doing with the outfitting where we need to skin a lot of deer. And maybe we only want a skinning knife for that. And then we want another knife that's like a gutting and then like a quartering knife. So kind of the same thing when you're talking about, you know, that your process behind what you build, you know, what should people be looking for those two knives for like blade shape and size?
Okay. Well, for skinning, I like a lot of belly in my knife, and that's referring to basically how deep the blade is from spine to edge.
Okay.
And with a lot of belly, so like the taller knives, with a lot of belly, you have a long curve. And that curve is real helpful for cutting along, you know, separating the fat layers between the hide and the meat without poking stuff and slicing stuff with the tip of your knife. And so, you know, like a rear sweeping blade or something like a drop point with a lot of belly is really useful for that. I lean towards the drop points just because they have more functionality the way I use them. Like I can use them for skinning and gutting and everything else without cutting into viscera and cutting into the guts. You know, sweeping blades have a habit of biting stuff with that tip. Same with clip points. They do the same thing, even though they definitely got their place. As far as, you know, gutting and quartering, I lean towards that shorter knife with, you know, not a ton of height in the blade. I like to be able to have some room to work around tight spots, especially the ball joints around the hip and on deer and elk and things like that. But it doesn't need to be huge. I mean, meat moves out of the way as you cut it. So there's not really any need to have some giant lightsaber machete when you're cutting.
Yeah.
And like I said, that longer blade's more of a liability than it is a help.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah, so we just had some hunters come in and the guy shot a deer and like he had already found it, whatever. I went down to help him. And usually I keep a little knife in the door of my pickup. For whatever reason, it wasn't there. So I didn't have a knife like a great guide, you know. And so I asked if anybody had a knife and the guy pulled his out and set it on the deer. And I went over and pulled it out of the sheath and it was like a K-bar. I mean, it was kind of big. And, you know, it was just not at all what I was used to. And it was that big blade. I mean, I don't know if 7-inch blade is unreal, but it was like a 7-inch blade. It was long.
That's huge.
Yeah. And just like, it was just too big. Like, I really wanted my little short one back.
Yeah, no, like, don't get me wrong. Like, I make big blades too. I've got one knife I made for a guy that had a 12-inch blade, but he wasn't cutting up animals or caping out skulls or anything like that with it. He wanted a machete type, you know, deal. But
yeah,
like, you know, camp use, splitting wood for your wood stove, you know, like when you're tent camping, things like that. Like, a bigger blade's great. I just don't think it's that great for cutting up animals. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. That's a pain. I've cut up animals with bigger knives and it's more work than it's worth.
Yeah. There's too much. There's too much up front there. Let's see. All right. One question we had was, blade angles. Like, is that angle, what angle are you going for there? And I'm sure we'll touch on it in the sharpening too.
Well, that's kind of a loaded question. So some of it depends on what kind of steel the knife is. Some of these new super steels, like I don't work with super steels, so I'm going to name off a few that I know of, but like 390, I think, is a super steel. Then you've got M2 and M4 and some of these crazier steels. They can handle really thin edges. Like, I mean, the edge itself is ground really thin, and then you can grind it really or sharpen it very shallow. I forget the angle that some of these guys are sharpening them at because I don't work with those, but you can sharpen them a lot more shallow. Think more like a fillet knife than a camp knife, you know, type of grind. Okay. And they can support that with the steel that, you know, it's made out of without chipping or rolling. The steels I work with, and I can explain in a minute why I work with them like the ones I do, but they don't do as well with the thin grinds, but they're easier to sharpen. So it's kind of a trade-off. And I typically grind everything freehand, kind of like a potter, you know, does everything by hand when they spin clay on the wheel. Everything I do is freehand and I do a convex grind. So we can go into that with sharpening a little bit here, but, basically instead of being ground flat, if you were to zoom in at a cross section of the edge, instead of looking like a V, it's kind of, I don't want to say an arch, like it's still sharp at the front, but it's rounded. The corners of that V are rounded off and it gives you a little bit of a performance edge.
yeah.
But it goes through meat a little bit better. It goes through wood way better and it's a little more durable. So it's hard to pin down the exact angle. Like I said, I do it by freehand and the way you sharpen a convex is also by freehand. So I know that's not the answer that fellow was probably looking for, but can't help you there on angles.
Yeah,
due to the nature of the way I grind my blades, but I can tell you that they work.
Yep, gotcha. So let's just keep rolling with those the steel options. Like, let's talk about the different steel options available for knives, and then, you know, maybe what to avoid, like when you see a really cheap knife, what steel they might be using and why, and then, you know, the higher end knives.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Go.
Yeah. So on the commercial end of things, CPM, S30, well, CPM 3V, S30V, Some of the 440 steels can be pretty nice. ATS 34, it's kind of like an entry level stainless, but if it's from a reputable, you know, maker, it can be pretty good. Those are all pretty solid steels as far as the stainless world goes. And then there's your carbon steels like 1095 and 01, and they will rust if you don't, you have to baby them, keep them dry, keep them oiled like you would a blued firearm, but they take an edge very well. They take a lot of abuse and they sharpen easy in the field. So those are all pretty good steels. As far as the cheaper stuff, if it's just this random amalgamation of letters and numbers, like 13C27 or something like that, there's a good chance it's from somebody that, there's a good chance it's a Walmart knife. Not that, yeah, Walmart doesn't have a couple, you know, commercial knives that are, you know, decent, but it's probably going to be Chinese made, not that great, soft, and just not be that great. So generally, if it's a steel you can look up and, you know, punch into your phone on Google and it pops up with a bunch of information from other knife makers, it's probably a good steel. But aside from the steel, heat treat's really important. So you can have a knife. Let's say you have Buck makes a knife in 440C, which is a stainless steel. And then you have a Chinese made knife in 440C. And then you've got a custom knife maker making a knife in 440C. You could say, man, that custom knife maker has a knife that's $500. It's in 440C, but Walmart has that knife over here for $10 in 440C. It's going to cut just as good as that $500 knife. Well, even if you had the same grind, there's a good chance it's not going to cut the same because it's a whole different heat treat. The cheap knife is going to be mass heat treated with little attention to detail, little attention to quality. It's probably going to be softer. It might have hard spots. Heck, it might be too hard. It might be brittle. The guy that does a custom job, and like a Buck is in the middle, Buck actually has a really good heat treat on their stuff with Paul Boss, or at least they did. I don't know if that's changed recently, but it's going to perform insanely well compared to the cheap one, even though it's the exact same steel. It's kind of like if you had a muscle car, put a brand new engine in it and didn't have the computer tuned, you could have an awesome engine, but if it's not tuned, it's going to run like crap. And it's the same with heat treats. So,
gotcha.
You know, it's worth mentioning.
Yeah.
Now on the custom knife maker end, there's a whole slew of steels that folks use. I can't talk about all of them. We'd be here for days, but I mess with three steels personally, generally speaking, and that's A2, which is a high carbon tool steel, super tough. They use it for making dies and tools and stuff in factories, you know, tools that are made to cut steel and stuff. That's A2. And then I've got AEBL, which is a steel that was formulated for the razor blade industry. It's extremely fine grained. It holds an edge really well. It field sharpens very well. So if you're stuck for some reason, you know, with a dull knife, you shouldn't get dull and trip. But if for some reason you have to sharpen it, you don't need to have special equipment to sharpen it. I've sharpened them with flattened river rocks in a pinch and it works.
Jeez.
So, yeah. And then the other one is 154CM, which is another fantastic steel.
Gotcha. Sweet. Just with that, since you touched on the heat treating, what is the process for heat treating, or what's the process that you use?
Well, I mean, yeah, the moon phase has to be right and you have to have a couple chickens to sacrifice. there's a lot of quote unquote witchcraft and heat treating. It's everybody's got their own thing. I actually farm out my heat treat to somebody right now. I'm hoping to go full time with the shop. It's a side hustle right now going into a full time gig, hopefully in the next couple months here, at which point I'll be doing my own. But in a nutshell, basically when you get steel, it's really soft. It's almost as soft as like construction grade soft steel. And it's on purpose. It's like that. It's got the potential to be hard, but it's softened. So you can work it and grind it and drill it. And then once you get it to roughly the shape you're going to work with, you have it heat treated, which involves bringing it up to a certain temperature that changes the molecular level of the steel, and then speed cooling it. In the movies, they're always quenching it in water or oil, and there's fire shooting up into the air. Sometimes certain steels only need to be air quenched, which is where they literally hold it in front of a fan. and that's cooling it enough to harden it. And some need water, some need oil. But at that point, it's so hard. If you were to drop it on concrete, it'd shatter like glass. And that's too hard to work with. So then you put it back in heat, but a different level of heat to soften it to a point where it's now a knife. And that's generally how heat treating works. There's some steels need to be normalized, which is like going up and down with the temperature. Some need to be cryogenically treated, which is where they're dipped in liquid nitrogen for a length of time. And that super cools the steel and does some more stuff to it. But basically that you're changing the steel into from, you know, soft steel into what you want your finished knife to be at, which is a balance of, you know, between too hard and too soft, something that's going to hold an edge, but not break on you.
Okay. Makes sense. Sounds like a science there, quite a bit of science. But
oh yeah, there are people that have like whole college degrees on metallurgy. It's a huge, super deep rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But I can get more technical if you want. But that's basically how it works. And like I said, some steels are super complex, and some of them you can literally do with a propane torch, a couple fire bricks, and a coffee can full of, you know, cooking oil. It just depends on what steel you're working with.
That's interesting. That's super interesting. So let's just go into sharpening now. You know, tools you can use. And I suppose that's going to depend. A lot of it's going to depend on what steel you have.
Not entirely. Not as much as you'd think. So most steels you can sharpen by hand at home. It just might take significantly longer. So the super steels we mentioned earlier, you can sharpen them by hand using sandpaper or a sharpening stone. You're going to take way longer to do it, and you're going to be really frustrated by the time you're done, but you can do it. I mean, no matter what, silicon carbide from sandpaper or aluminum oxide in a sharpening stone are harder than any of our steels that we have. It's just whether or not it's going to be efficient. If you're one of those people that likes gear and likes buying nice stuff, there's a thing called a work sharp. It's basically a miniature belt sander. It's like a half inch or quarter inch wide belt by like 6 inches. And it's got a jig built onto it that holds your knife at the appropriate angle. And it actually sharpens a convex edge like I was talking about before. And you can buy, I want to say they're about $100 if I remember right. They come with the belts and everything. You can replace the belts, and it's small. It's like the size of, I don't know, like a Yeti mug, you know. It's not very big. And you can sharpen just about anything on one of those things, no matter what the steel is. So there's that route. That's the upper end, also the one of the easiest. And then there's, you know, the grandpa sharpening stone on the bench. That still works. It's stood the test of time, and it still works. My favorite way to sharpen is I actually kind of get that whole method and flip it upside down. So I get a small knife stone, which is like the size of an old pack of gum from back in the day, back when they weren't shaped like a wallet. And I actually hold the knife on the table with like a light overhead so I can see the reflection off the edge. And I actually put the stone to the knife and work it in a circular pattern, kind of like how somebody would sharpen an axe. And with super light pressure, I can see, if I'm working with a coarser grit first, I can see where I'm scratching the shiny part of the steel off and working the edge. And you can cheat if you're not used to doing that. You can put Sharpie on the edge, and then you can see where you're working the Sharpie off.
Oh.
So if you know you need to go closer to the edge, you go steeper or farther back. And you just work in a circular pattern all the way along that side, and then you feel for a burr. If there's a burr on the back side of your edge where you can feel with your finger, then you're done on that side. Do the other side. And then from there, take it to a leather strop with compound. And you can have that thing hair shaving sharp with little effort, if assuming the edge wasn't, you know, like butter knife dull.
Interesting.
And then the last method is the weirdest by most people's standards is sandpaper. If you get automotive grade wet dry sandpaper, you can buy touch up kits from hardware stores, Walmart, Lowe's. You can get it in like 600, 800, 1,000, all the way up to 2,500 grit. And it comes in like a 4 inch by 8 inch strips. And if you set those on a piece of foam, so like, well, I used to say mouse pads, but nobody has a mouse anymore on their computers. You can buy super thin foam. It's like 16th inch thick at Walmart in the craft section. Same stuff. And if you set the sandpaper on top of that on your counter, put a little bit of water on the paper, and you drag your knife instead of push it. Just like you would a sharpening stone, but you're dragging. The foam underneath it gives just a tiny bit, and the sandpaper conforms to that contour of the convex edge as it removes steel, and it polishes at the same time. And takes a little bit of practice, probably the most practice out of all three methods that I'm talking about. But when you're done, you can have an extremely sharp knife. And it works on broadheads, it works on knives, works on all kinds of stuff.
Gotcha. What about, you know, when you go to the hardware store and when you go to check out, they have the little, you know, like you could buy candy bars or whatever, or like chapstick. What about their little knife sharpeners that you like drag the knife through?
Oh, I hate those things so much. So those do work. I grew up, like, my mom had one that had, my mom and dad, you know, but anyway, that they had one that was two carbide wheels side by side. You drug it between them.
Okay.
Same concept, and it works. But if you, well, for starters, the ones at the hardware store have two little ceramic sticks that are crisscrossing.
Yep.
And the problem I have with them, the first and foremost problem I have with them, is when you get them, there's a sharp, clean V where those two, you know, crisscross. But as you sharpen, that ceramic does wear down, at which point that sharp V turns into a rounded V. And at some point, it's a super steep rounded V, and you're not getting very good performance out of your knife. If you're sharpening all the time, your edge is continually degrading each time you sharpen because the ceramic's degrading. So that's the first problem I have with them. They work, but if you're going to sharpen a lot, I'm not a big fan. The second problem I have with them is if you were to zoom in like a microscope on your edge, as you're sharpening, you're putting, even if it's a mirror edge, you're putting grind marks, like scratches on the steel that run perpendicular to your edge. And when you're cutting, like say meat, those act almost like serrations, micro serrations, and they help cut. Even if the edge loses its potency, you still have the coarseness of that, even if you can't feel it, that helps you cut. If you're dragging through something, you're running those scratch marks with the edge instead of across the edge. So you actually lose that as a benefit. Like you lose that benefit, not as a benefit. And so when it goes dull, it goes dull. The effect is a lot faster of going dull.
Gotcha. Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah. What are some ways that, let's see, maybe a couple of common ways that people like screw their knives up sharpening? Like, can you ruin one?
Well, if you're not using power tools, you can ruin a knife if you're using power tools. overheating a knife till it turns colors, that ruins a heat treat, at which point it's not gonna hold an edge well. It's not gonna perform well anymore. But as far as hand sharpening, you can't really technically ruin a knife. I mean, even if you were to grind the edge completely off at 90 degrees, you can resharpen it back to an edge. Just won't be as pretty. I mean, I'm sure everybody's seen those pocket knives that show up at auctions and stuff, because our estate auctions, grandpa's old folding, you know, pocket knife. And it's ground back to looking like a tiny little fillet knife blade because he sharpened it 47 million times.
Yeah.
It still cuts. You know, as long as he hasn't ruined the heat treat, old grandpa's knife will still cut. Same thing applies. You can sharpen it back. There's good knife steel all the way back through that knife. Pretty much any knife. So as long as you're not overheating it, you're pretty much good to go there. You can change your angle of your grind, and you know, if you grind your edge too thin, it's going to roll or chip easily. If you like, as far as the angle, and if you grind it too steep as you're sharpening, you can lose your cutting performance, but not much can't be fixed when it comes to that, aside from overheating.
Gotcha. Super interesting. Now what about maintenance? Things you should be doing to like maintain your knife, I guess, besides sharpening. I am super bad at end of the year. You know, we'll skin the last deer, hands are all bloody, I'll throw it back in the sheath, throw it in the door of my truck or throw it in my pack or whatever. And then next time we go out to do something, I pull it out and I forgot to clean it. That's not good. I don't think people should do that. But I'm the worst.
I'll crush you with blood and fat.
Yep, I'm the worst at that. So besides just cleaning it off, what are some other things that people should do, you know, like oil or whatever?
Some of that depends on what steel you're working with. So if you've got high carbon steels, like technically all knife steels are high carbon, but non-stainless steels in your knife. So like 1095, there's a zillion makers that use 1095. I think, if I remember, I think the Taito fixed blade, I think that's 1095. It might be S30V. If it's 1095, that's one that can rust. I can't remember. But anyway, if it's 1095, for example, even though they're coated and they coat the whole entire thing to prevent rust, the edge itself can rust. So it's a good idea to wipe that dry and then put a thin film oil on it. So just like a little drop of gun oil, or I like mineral oil because it's food safe, and just wipe it across the edge. And that keeps moisture off, keeps it from rusting. You think if the whole entire knife is clean because of the coating, that edge itself isn't. And if that edge rusts, it actually dulls the knife. Aside from not looking pretty, mm-hmm. It does dull the knife. And so you want to keep that nice and clean and dry, just like anything else. So there's that. But in addition to that, think about the handle too. So if you have, your friend with the K-bar.
Yeah.
You have that stacked leather handle, for example. That stuff is really bad about not dealing well with moisture. So you want to make sure that you treat it like with a leather handle. You'd want to treat it with whatever the manufacturer recommends. I want to say neatsfoot oil is a good thing to treat it with. But you want to keep it dry and clean that handle material. If you're using like a wood handle, even if it's a stabilized wood handle, you want to make sure you keep it dry, wipe it down with a thin film of like vegetable oil or cutting oil, cutting board oil. And basically it keeps moisture out from expanding and swelling and cracking the materials. Same with antler, any of the natural materials. You want to think about that. Just because, some of us spend good money on our knives. We want them to stay nice for a really long time. So water is pretty much your worst enemy when it comes to that.
Gotcha. Since we were talking about handles a little bit, let's talk about fit, size of the handle and fit, you know, besides just being comfortable, is there anything else that people should keep in mind when they're handling a knife, like in the, in a store or whatever, debating to buy it or not?
Yeah. So if you want, I'll start with the heavy end of the spectrum, say a camp knife. You don't care about it being super nimble in the hand, but you want it to be hand filling. So you might be making feather sticks or fuzz sticks, splitting wood for your tent stove, things like that. You want a thick handle because you want to be able to keep a heavy, good control on it, dampen vibration as you're, beating it through wood and things like that. So you want something that's going to fill the hand like full, like a hammer handle. And that's pretty much my main concern with a camp knife, with something that you're going to be skinning and gutting and caping and things like that. I want a knife that handles more like a scalpel, but still there's enough handle there that it's not going to like cramp my hands up if I'm working with it for more than 10 minutes. So I pick up the knife and I hold it, your standard hammer grip. And then I'll hold it with three fingers and run my finger along the spine of the knife. Aside from the blade length we talked about, I still do that even with longer knives because it gives you a better, better control, more delicate mm-hmm. control of the whole edge. So I like to see how a knife feels in my hand and that handle, like orientation in my hand. And then sometimes I'll even pick it up and use it like, I wanted to say like a pencil, but almost like you would hold a pencil with like the handle like floating in the air on a bigger knife. So I'm actually just holding the blade, but my hand is on top of the knife. So the edge is still underneath my hand, but basically pinching the blade between I'm looking at my hand right now, index and mm-hmm. or my ring and middle fingers mm-hmm. and my thumb, and my index fingertip is on the tip of the knife for, working in tight areas. If it's a bigger knife, I'll do that. I want to see how the knife is going to feel. If it's got a really big, heavy handle, that's going to really put the whooping on that being an effective technique. Not that it's a deal breaker, but it's something to think about. You want to have a knife that's going to, you know, not be obtrusive. You don't want it to be bigger than you need, and you don't want it to be super small and cramping your hand up either. So it's a good trade-off you're looking for. And a lot of that depends on your hand size. You know, if you've got a really small hand, you can get away with a lot less. If you've got a huge hand, you know, big, giant, extra, extra large hands, something small isn't going to cut it either.
Gotcha. Yeah, makes sense. Definitely makes sense. So I think those are pretty much all the questions I had. What is your knife like? What does your lineup look like? Is everything made to order?
Yeah, pretty much everything's made to order. Occasionally I'll do an extra blade here or there and put it up for open sale on Instagram, but generally it's made to order. Anybody wants to order one, just gets a hold of me and shoots me a message, and you know, I put them on the wait list. But yeah, I pretty much make everything to order. I've got I lost track of the number, 18 different models, and basically somebody can pick out a model that they like, and then from there we can talk about what steel might, you know, fit their needs the best, what blade thickness, grind height, and then handle materials, which are mostly, you know, personal preference as far as looks, but it's all made custom to order. So there's very few knives that are alike. They're all very much personal to the owner.
Gotcha.
Which is probably 90% of why I love doing it.
Yeah, that's super cool. Can they do engravings and things like that too?
Right now I don't do any engravings. That's going to be in the future though.
Sweet.
Maybe some custom laser etching probably down the road.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I was talking to a friend last night about, that's such a great gift, a Christmas gift, is if you could laser etch, a brand or a name or whatever into it and give it as a gift. That'd be super cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something special about having a knife that's 100% you, you know, or made for you or whatever, because you look back in all these old Western movies, and they always have that one bad guy that has that one pistol that everybody knows. And they find it in the desert somewhere, and they're like, oh, man, that's Crazy Jack pistol. They know exactly who it is. Well, I mean, it's cool to have a knife that's like that. It's you. It's made for you, you know, specifically to your specs, to your tastes and preferences. And, you know, when you pick it up and pull it out of your pack, it's not just oh, there's that knife I picked up at the store. Man, there's that knife that I waited 6 months for, 8 months for, spent a whole lot of time looking at Instagram or, you know, whatever, looking at pictures of different stuff, figuring out what I wanted and talk to the maker about, you know, there's that thing that's super custom. There's something cool about that, you know?
Oh, for sure. I'm a super sentimental person too. So having something like that, that you can give to somebody, or, you know, just looking at a knife that's been on every hunt you've ever been on, you know, that's super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably a good portion of why I like doing it. I've got pictures of knives I've made and sent to people that are, you know, sitting on top of doll sheep in Alaska or Cape Buffalo in Africa and things like that, that are just really cool because for one, they're getting to use their knife on really cool adventures. But two, it feels like, I don't know, in a really small, really sad way, I'm a part of that trip too,
which
is kind of cool. Cause I made that knife and, you know, finished it by hand and everything and boxed it up by hand and sent it out. Now it's doing really cool stuff. So I get what you mean about being sentimental. Cause I'm the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, that's awesome. Is there anything else you want to kind of wrap the episode up with?
Other than, I think it's cool to it's cool to be on here. First off, thanks for having
me.
And I think it's cool that people are starting to get into looking at cutting implements seriously, and not just for self-interest, but purposes. But, I don't know, for the longest time, I grew up in a world where everybody just grabbed a Buck knife from Walmart, and I'm not hating on Buck. That's just the name brand. That's Mountain House, you know? And I think it's always been an afterthought. And we're getting into a world now, or a time now, where everybody has super dialed gear, you know, we've got, you know, Kafaru and Exo and Stone Glacier. And we spend a small fortune on just figuring out what pockets we want in our packs and what kind of sleeping bag we want. And I think it's time we start thinking about dialing our edge tools the same way, you know? So you know, I think anybody that's looking into doing this, first off, if anybody has any questions and wants to hit me up, feel free to hit me up, even if it's not about my stuff. I mean, just, you know, I'm happy to help. But two, really think about, you know, what your needs are and stuff. You know, I mean, like if you're one of those people that's going to be always in the backcountry and you don't want to focus on maintenance, spend that extra money and get a higher end steel and get some synthetic handle materials and something you could put in the pack and forget about, even if you get rained on. And, you know, maybe if you're super sentimental and like things to age like wine, then get that carbon steel knife and baby it and watch it darken over time and, you know, develop memories as you do.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Really think hard about what you're going to get, because there's a lot of cool stuff you can do out there.
Yeah, dude, that's perfect. Well, I thank you for taking the time to hop on, because this was a super informational podcast, and I think people are going to get a lot of good out of it. Where can people check out your knives and then find you on Instagram?
It's all on Simbita Custom Knives Instagram page. I've got a website in the works, but it's been a really hectic fall.
Yeah, I hear you.
Haven't had a chance to get finished yet, but hopefully by New Year's, I'll have a website up too. But right now it's pretty much just through Instagram, and I've got pretty much any knife I've made I have on there for the most part. So you can look on there and see anything I've made. And if I haven't made it, it doesn't mean I can't make it. It just means I haven't made it yet.
Gotcha. So
pretty much as far as handle materials go, I'm down to work with almost anything except carbon fiber. I'm not a fan of carbon fiber. Tough evil.
Are there carbon fiber handles?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Big time. It's just, it's a pain in the rear to grind. Like it grinds really easy. It sands really easy. It finishes really easy. But the dust, it's like talcum powder, you know, and it gets on your skin. It's like black talcum powder. And then you go to blow it off or wipe it off, and it doesn't wipe off. It wipes into your skin.
Ew.
Like it's all like a billion micro razor blades, and they just go into your skin. And anybody that's worked with fiberglass house insulation knows that prickly feeling for like 2 days.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's like that, but it's like that times 1,000. It's awful. And no matter, like, you have to wear a full Tyvek suit and have a full head sealing respirator and everything else in order to avoid that. And it's just no fun.
No
fun at all.
Doesn't sound good. No, we just took a whole bunch of old insulation out of a renovation that we're doing, and that stuff was in my arm hairs forever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that stuff's awful.
It's the worst.
I did a single wide once. I did the underside of a single wide a couple of years back, and it was just, oof.
Horrible.
I don't ever want to do that again.
No. So with that, even if you were, like, if somebody were to get a carbon fiber handled knife, like, that feeling or whatever that stuff, could they get that in the future? Like even with a finished handle?
No.
No, not at all.
No, not at all. It's just the dust. It's just like, I'll try to think, like for example, drywall. When you're sanding drywall, you got to have a respirator on because the dust will totally screw up your lungs. But you can live in a house that has drywall all over the place and never have an issue because you're not grinding it. So it's the same with carbon fiber. Once it's done being ground, like the solid material itself is completely harmless. It's just the dust. The dust is real nasty.
Gotcha. Not good.
Arrows are the same way. If you go to an arrow shop, guys cut arrows, they've got like a giant vacuum attached to the arrow saw for that same reason, because the dust from the arrows are the same exact way. They'll tear you up.
Gotcha. Not good. Not a good thing. But man, yeah, thanks. Thanks again. And, yeah, good luck on your new venture going full time.
Thanks. Yeah, hopefully it works and I can pull it off, because I've been pushing for it for a while now. It finally feels like it might be a reality. So,
yeah, it'll be a good time.